And I just want to say to all of you, we are in this for the long run. I heard today about some things that still need to be done. And we will not have our work done until everybody in this part of our country who wants a job has one, until people are back in their homes, until these communities are rebuilt.
I'm speaking to you from the city of New Orleans, nearly empty, still partly underwater, and waiting for life and hope to return. When communities are rebuilt, they must be even better and stronger than before the storm. The streets of Biloxi and Gulfport will again be filled with lovely homes and the sound of children playing.
As you can see, as you travel around parts of Staten Island, there's still a lot of cleanup to do. What we've also already heard is that there's going to be some long-term rebuilding that's required. There's got to be a plan for rebuilding. And that plan is going to have to be coordinated, and there's going to need resources.
So 2.5 weeks ago, over 100-mile-an-hour winds transformed the Palisades Fire and other areas too into absolute infernos of death and destruction. I met so many of the homeowners, and every one of them, a lot of them, and every one of them said to me they want to rebuild. I said, will you go elsewhere? No, 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 no. It wasn't even like a question.
You just heard four American presidents going back 30 years making essentially the same speech. In the wake of catastrophic disasters, they all committed to rebuilding communities that were destroyed. Rebuilding after a disaster is in our DNA as Americans. It has become a measuring stick for our disaster recovery efforts. And there are good and bad reasons for this. For one, people need a place to live. They need to be safe. They need to get back to work. Their kids need to go to school. They also may have nowhere else to go. As you just heard President Donald Trump say, they may not want to go anywhere else. But rebuilding doesn't necessarily mean that our homes and communities are safer. It doesn't mean that the risk is gone. It doesn't mean that we will be able to afford our homeowners insurance or that we will even be able to get that insurance. It also doesn't mean that our homes won't be destroyed again. The conversation I want to have today is a difficult one. It's a controversial one. It's also really relevant and especially painful now. When we are recording this, we're about 6 months out from the disastrous fires in LA, where thousands of people are currently grappling with rebuilding. And right now in Texas, over 100 people have been killed in catastrophic flooding in communities that have been devastated by an unprecedented flood disaster. Nonetheless, this is an important conversation to have in this moment. For the most part, our society and governments are committed to rebuilding after disasters. But there is an entire world of NGOs and government agencies committed to the opposite goal, getting people out of there. So the burning question I want to discuss is this: what's the right answer? Should we rebuild after a disaster? And how do we do it if we do? To answer this, Doug and I wanted to invite our colleague, Kristen Smith, on to talk through some answers to these questions. Chris is an expert on flooding and government funding, and she spends a lot of time making communities safer and has strong feelings on this topic. So with that, let's get into it. Chris, Doug, thanks so much for joining me today. Happy to have you both here. There is something about rebuilding in particular that has always really haunted me, and it's this idea that can this happen again if people rebuild in a floodplain or in a wildfire zone? What are the chances that they'll lose their home again or maybe their lives? And I often wonder if our determination to rebuild is really setting communities up for failure. And I know we get asked this question a lot in our work. So I want to talk about how do we answer this? And is there anything we can learn from each other since we have different perspectives in our different fields of work? But let's just back up a bit first and paint a picture of what rebuilding is and what it looks like. So, Doug, let's start with the wildfire piece. What happens when a wildfire destroys a community, and what does rebuilding typically look like?
Well, yeah, thanks, Ryan. I think rebuilding in these communities, for people on the outside, seems painfully slow because we have to remember that it's this complex problem that doesn't involve just putting structures back on the land. You have an environment that has been severely damaged by fire response. We have bulldozer lines, we have landing pads, we have fire operations areas, we have hazardous materials left when homes burn down, we have cars that are left in the roads that are burned up. There's this huge time period managing those hazards, managing erosion issues. You have to put in the water lines again, potentially the hydrants, the power, the streets. You know, heat can cause significant damage to asphalt. And getting all that infrastructure in before you can even get into the lots and start that rebuilding piece. And that's what people want to see, right? They want to see houses go back up right away so people can live in there. But it's a long process, and most communities are ill-prepared for what that entails because they don't have pre-planning, pre-disaster plans made up that not if, but when our community burns or faces a flood, what are we going to do? The day after that, how do we work through these steps to get it back so we can rebuild structures and have people move back into there?
So I think, Chris, there'll be a lot of similarities here in the flooding world that you represent. But I think one difference that we have is that building in wildfire zones is not universally regulated by a land use code. So when you rebuild, there are no guidelines on how you do it after a wildfire. And I think that's not the case with flooding. So tell me what happens after a flood destroys homes in a floodplain or even outside of a floodplain.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. It's a great question. I'm going to start by taking a 30,000-foot view of this and just add a little bit to what Doug was saying. There's a question here of who gets to decide what rebuilding looks like. And according to FEMA, at least in its current shape and form, really a lot of that onus and responsibility is on the local community. When it comes to a flood disaster, the phases of disaster are really important. And that's what Doug was starting to talk about. That initial response, you're in crisis mode, you're just trying to save lives and get basic infrastructure online. As you start coming into the recovery phase, you're going to start thinking more about temporary housing and what can we do? And that's the point where FEMA comes in and starts meeting with people and saying, do we want to do things a little bit differently, right, in that early recovery process? And then their full recovery process is something that typically is going to take years and years and years, you know, a decade, could be more. Flood is a little bit unique, and definitely unique and different from wildfire, in that we do have things like FEMA floodplain risk maps and also the National Flood Insurance Program. And so what that means is if you're a community that has flood risk maps and you participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, you have to comply with regulation, including the special flood hazard area. So if you want to rebuild and you're in a floodplain, that means you have to go and work with your local floodplain administrator to get the right permits. And it's really important here to comply, because if the community fails to get those regulations enforced, you can go on probation, you can get kicked out, and then all of a sudden you don't have access to flood insurance, which means you might not have access to mortgages, and there's all kinds of cascading effects. It's a little bit more regulated than, say, wildfire, but I think it's still important to emphasize that what that process looks like in the long term is really the community's decision. And just like what Doug was saying, so many communities, when they experience this disaster, if they haven't thought this through, they don't have a vision for what they want their community to become. There's no way you're going to be able to create that plan in a moment of crisis after a disaster.
So this is the thing I find interesting about flooding, and why I think it's a unique disaster that can teach us quite a bit when it comes to wildfires, is that flooding happens again very frequently, more so, I think, than wildfires. And that means flooding happens often in the exact same neighborhood year after year. So I'm curious, in the flood infrastructure that you just talked about, how does rebuilding come into play when it's being done time and time again?
There are a lot of places that have repetitive flooding. And what that does is, from what I've seen, at least working with communities, is that can actually build political and community will to do something about it. Whether that's coming together as a community and thinking about, is there a way to create a community-wide project that will reduce risk, or that's working at the individual scale, what can we do to make this particular home safer? Does it need to be elevated? Does it need to be bought out? Do we need to invest in really good temporary floodproofing, like sandbags and things like that? The other thing that can happen when you have repetitive flooding, particularly if you're an NFIP community, so again, a community that participates in the National Flood Insurance Program, if you have repetitive loss properties or even severe repetitive loss properties, basically these are just homes where there are multiple claims within a given amount of time, you can get prioritized for different pools of mitigation funding. So will the federal government in this context ever say to someone who's had multiple floods in their neighborhood or their home, will they ever say, you cannot rebuild and we're not going to give you a payout to rebuild in this spot? That's not how the National Flood Insurance Program works. Again, if you have a repetitive flood property, they'll get marked as that and they can be prioritized. But there's not a policy currently in place that would limit the number of claims you can have for an FIP.
So, Doug, I think this is fascinating for us to think about in a wildfire context. People often say to me, well, once we've had a wildfire in our neighborhood and all the trees burned down, there will never be another fire here for a generation or two. And I have to agree to a certain extent, it's very hard to see wildfires as a recurrent disaster the way we've watched recurrent flooding in places, like I mentioned. And so I think sometimes it's harder to make the case in a wildfire context that rebuilding is risky. But what do you think?
Well, I would disagree with you. I think when we understand how fires burn down communities, and when we understand that it's not usually a forest fire that comes into a community and devastates it, it is usually fires within a community throwing embers onto that community, lighting ignitable things within the community, right? So even if you have a wildfire that burns through and takes out the majority of the, let's say, the mature trees, within a year or two, you have regrowth of vegetation. And usually that regrowth is grasses, brushes that are flashy fuels that burn quickly, burn hot. And so you suddenly then have the fuels to spark a fire near or in the community, right? And you have a community that is probably ill-prepared for that because a lot of them have thought, we no longer have that issue. We don't need to be prepared for that now, even though, again, if you have a grass fire outside of a community, it can shower that community with sparks and still cause the same devastation as before. And in my career as a firefighter, I've seen multiple places where we've had a big fire burn through, and a couple years later, cheatgrass and sagebrush has burned again right through the same fire scars. Sometimes it's even more dangerous because that fuel is so dry and it just doesn't hold the moisture like a mature tree does. It can ignite really quickly and burn really fast. So I think you're right in some cases, Ryan, that the type of fire and sometimes the magnitude of the fire that hit a community may be less or different, but the risk is not, I don't believe, any less.
One thing I find interesting about talking about our perception of risk for both flooding and fires is I think we all have a fundamental misunderstanding of how often these disasters occur. As with wildfire, you just said, people don't always understand that the fuel that's feeding the fire is their home, not necessarily the forest that burned around them. And the flooding piece that I find interesting is the way we talk about flooding. You know, this was a once in 1,000-year flood. This is a once in 100-year flood. And it tends to sound like, well, this will only happen, you know, once in my lifetime or once in a millennia. But what actually it reflects is the odds of that happening every year. And that's really deceptive, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the way we've talked about floods is pretty misleading. So we talk about like a 100-year flood is a really common metric. And I've talked to many communities when they experience that, they're like, oh, we're good, you know, for years and years. We don't have to worry. Well, it's a 1% chance that you'll flood in any given year. So the next year it resets. And then the other thing that we know, and I'm sure we'll talk more about our flood risk maps, we know that when you look at what floods, 40% of the claims for any given flood to the National Flood Insurance Program actually are for properties that are outside that 100-year flood risk area. Almost half of our claims are coming from places that don't have regulatory flood risk. So it just emphasizes that there are regulations in place to try to limit and protect communities, but they are not meant to communicate the full risk of any given property. If you live in a place that rains, you have flood risk, regardless of whether you're in the floodplain or not.
That's a really great point. In previous episodes, we sort of held up our approach to flooding in this country as somewhat of an example, mostly because we've been mapping floodplains for more than half a century now, and we've at least have some base understanding of where the flood risk is. Even if it's not complete, it is there. And by contrast, As we discussed in our episode on wildfire risk mapping, that type of mapping is relatively recent. It's pretty inconsistent, and it could vary greatly from organization to organization or agency to agency. So while we may have a pretty good idea of where flooding on some level will happen, it is less clear where the next wildfire will happen.
Wildfire mapping is tough. I mean, we have excellent tools that predict the potential for fire behavior with specific conditions, but when you take the inherently randomness of ignitions, the changing in fuels, the changing in topography, the changing in the weather, it makes pinpointing where that next wildfire is going to be and how big it's going to be extremely challenging. It's always evolving. I mean, the reasons why wildfire mapping is less clear than flooding is the nature of the hazard itself. Predicting where that next wildfire is going to be is virtually impossible because we just do not know where those ignitions are going to be, what the wind's going to be doing. And again, forests change. It changes every day.
And I think the same thing happens with flooding, at least in a river context. You know, we tend to think of rivers as these like immutable, permanent structures in the landscape, but they actually move quite a bit. And the floodplain doesn't really capture where the river has been or where it's going to go. Do you think that's a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, I think water is really unruly. That's the nature of water. So, but when you talk about floodplain maps, FEMA's floodplain maps are really the gold standard of helping us understand flood risk. And that's important to emphasize because there are many countries that don't have anything like that tool. So when you're trying to find what's the standard that we should build to, that engineers can use, that communities can regulate to, it's really important to have these floodplain maps. And at the same time, we know that they do have some shortcomings. So we don't have them nationwide. There are places that don't have any floodplain maps. For some of the places in the country, the data is incredibly outdated. At Headwaters Economics, we work with a lot of more rural communities in remote regions, and it's very common for us to be looking at floodplain maps, and they might be digitized, but when you actually dig into them, the data is dating back to the 70s, 80s. You can imagine how far we've come in the last 40, 50 years in floodplain modeling. And then the other thing I think that you're touching on, Ryan, is just that these floodplain maps are static. We know that rivers are changing all the time. They've always changed. We know that climate change is making things worse. We're seeing more intense rainfalls that are not always incorporated into our floodplain maps. And so there's been some transition into thinking about how can we better think about flood risk, maybe thinking about something like a channel migration map, which looks at where did the river used to be, how has it moved, and how is it likely to move going forward? And should we be regulating to that standard and not just the floodplain?
Yeah, so what I think you're getting at, Chris, is there's a very real risk that a flood or fire can happen again in the same community. And we need these understandings of where it can happen to help us figure out what comes next, how we rebuild, how we regulate that. And based on our mapping, we can't always get a reliable picture of where it is safe to build or where it is safe to rebuild. So this says to me that disasters, in a weird way, offer a false sense of security, right? People think, well, we had our 100-year flood for this year, or we had our wildfire for our generation, when in reality, their neighborhood can burn again and can flood again. So given that these risks are much larger than these gold standard maps that we have captured, it makes me think this is a strong argument against rebuilding.
The problem with not rebuilding in the wildfire piece is I don't know where to tell people to rebuild when it comes to wildfire. In flooding, and this isn't always true, but in a lot of cases, you could ask somebody to move a mile away out of the floodplain. Their home would be safe. They'd still be in the same community. Kids would go to the same school, same jobs, etc. In wildfire, that's often not the case. If they want to promise that their home is not going to burn again, they may have to move a county away, a state away. It's not easy to tell people where they can move to be safe from wildfire. So telling people that they need to relocate is extremely complicated, and I don't think it is a realistic solution to get people out of wildfire risk areas.
And so we're bringing up relocation here because if we're going to say, okay, you can't rebuild, then relocation is inherent. And you're reminding me, Doug, of some of the work that we've done recently at Headwaters to map urban conflagrations and where these can happen based on a few common characteristics that have to do with the type of vegetation, the weather patterns, and the density of structures. And we have found in that research that wildfire risk exists in places that even I have never thought of it being in. I brought this up in a previous episode, but I'm still really struck by it. Biloxi, Mississippi is on our map of urban conflagration risk. So are places in Iowa and Arkansas. So as you said, a lot of people may think, well, it could just be as simple as you need to leave California, you need to leave Colorado. What you're saying is, no, it's not that easy.
Yeah, it's not that easy. And I mean, for a lot of reasons. One is because there's not a lot of safe places they can go. And two, obviously, the financial ramifications are not tenable. The solution for that is understanding that you're in that risky area and to build and to mitigate your property and vegetation appropriately for that. And there's simple things you can do that not only can save your home, but can save the community around your home. I think that's a solution for people in wildfire areas.
So, Chris, you and I have had debates about this. I come from a perspective where I've long been fascinated by relocation and moving people out of harm's way, but you've given me some really compelling reasons in the past why rebuilding is a good idea. So talk about how you think of the decision not to rebuild in the flood context. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Doug and I just discussed. Where else do you go?
I think when you do have a flood, there is kind of this moment after that can galvanize people to think creatively about what's next. And in some places at the community scale, that has included relocating the entire community. These tend to be communities that are very small. We've seen this in Alaska, particularly around places that have really severe erosion from sea level rise, where your options are pretty limited about what you do to mitigate that risk. We've seen this in Nebraska. There's a community called Winslow that is entirely in the floodplain. Very small community of less than 100 people. And they're actively thinking about relocating the entire community to a hill that is much safer. Whether or not they will be able to pull that off with resources and to garner the full community will to do that, it's, you know, to be seen. And I think that just emphasizes what Doug was saying, which is like, that's a massive effort. It takes a ton of money, it takes a lot of buy-in to do a project like that. What we see more commonly in the flood world are individual buyouts. That is a very common tool to decrease flood risk. There are some states that is their top goal, is to just do buyouts after floods to get people out of the floodplain, particularly along the Mississippi River Basin, where you have repetitive flooding year after year.
So hold on just a second. So to break down the buyout thing just a bit. So basically a buyout is when your home floods, and you decide that for whatever reason, you're done. You're not fixing your home. You're not rebuilding it. You want out. And the government will help you get out. Explain a little bit how a buyout works briefly.
Yeah, it's an important tool in the toolbox. It's a local decision. If you're using federal funding, it has to be voluntary. So there's nothing, you can't do eminent domain with this tool, at least with federal funding. So household residents will say, we've hit our end. We don't want to be in this location anymore. And instead of just trying to sell their house and pass the problem down the line, they go through a buyout process. So the local community works with the state government and often tries to access federal funding, either through FEMA or HUD, to do either a property buyout or an acquisition. But the idea is the flood risk is so extreme that really the best use of this property is to open it back up to the river and allow the flooding to occur more naturally. There are lots of really good reasons why you should do a flood buyout. Again, particularly if you have the most extreme flood risk. And there can also be reasons why a community might not want to do that. Some of the things that can come up and happen with these buyout programs is because it has to be voluntary in a neighborhood, you can have one neighbor say, I'm done. I want out. I will go through the buyout program. And the next doesn't. And the next does. And the next doesn't. You can basically get these checkerboard patterns that really disrupt the social fabric of your neighborhood. These programs also, because they are federal funding, they're heavily regulated, they can take a really long time up to 5 years even. So you might have a resident who says, okay, I'm interested in a buyout in the immediate after effects of a flood. But as they go through all the paperwork and the, you know, working through the regulations and the permits, they might give up. They might sell their property instead. They might decide they're not interested. So the rate of people leaving those programs is very high. And then there's also questions about what do you do with the tax loss and also the property. So if you think about a neighborhood that generating property taxes to help fund the local government, really critical source of revenue, if those properties get bought out and the people leave town, then all of a sudden that local government has taken a hit on the revenue side. And in addition, typically the local government owns the property that was purchased. And so now all of a sudden they have increased maintenance costs for that property. How are you going to maintain that property? What are you going to do with it? If it's a park, there's going to be a cost for that, for example.
Yeah.
So there can be real budget implications to these programs as well.
Just to summarize kind of, I think, what I'm hearing from you both is that it is very hard to say we're not going to rebuild after a disaster because, Doug, as you said, there's often nowhere safer to go. And then, Chris, as you said, there are, at least in the flood world, there are mechanisms to get people out, but they're few and far between. They're difficult. They're expensive. They're not easy to implement. And it's rare to have the answer post-flood be, let's get out of here. Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Handy from Headwaters Economics. I want to thank you for listening to our podcast, and I encourage you to share it with your friends, coworkers, and community members. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have any of your own burning questions about wildfire issues in your community, please email them to me at ryan@headwaterseconomics.org. So now we're assuming then that we might need to rebuild after a disaster. That's probably the best course of action, specifically after a flood and a fire. I think that what we need to tease through now is there are a lot of other risks that communities face post-disaster that aren't just about another fire or another flood. And Chris, you started talking about this a little bit, and so did you, Doug. Disasters have really severe consequences on local finances and taxes, on livelihoods, on housing, on public health. So when we are deciding whether or not it's riskier to rebuild or to leave a community altogether, the risk of a future disaster is far from the only thing we need to take into account. So Chris, let's start with you on this. Tell me a bit about some of these other consequences and talk a bit about what disasters do to local economies.
So disasters can have really far-reaching and really long-term and rippling impacts throughout the economy, again, through housing, through infrastructure. And there are certain types of communities that are probably more exposed to these types of impacts. So I tend to think about a lot of our more rural communities with lower capacity. They might not be as experienced with accessing state and federal resources and might have a harder time getting those resources on the ground. And the places with specialized economies, which again tend to be our more rural places, they can also be very exposed. So I always think about the best example here could be our 2022 floods in the Yellowstone area. So in our backyard here at Headwaters Economics, when that flood hit our region, because we're so tourism dependent, all of a sudden, all of the tourism flows into Yellowstone National Park were cut off. And you can imagine the hundreds of businesses that were incredibly reliant on those tourists to show up. And so we've seen really long-term impacts and massive decreases, not only in tax revenues and lodging revenues and things like that, but also job cuts. And we saw similar things with that same flood. A mine was impacted and went offline for 2 weeks. And so you can imagine in a very rural county like Stillwater County here in Montana, if you don't have those jobs for 2 weeks, the rippling impacts from that. So context matters a lot here when you're thinking about what happens to a community. The worst case scenario is kind of what I call these spiraling impacts, where you have a big flood hits a region that's particularly exposed to the impacts of disasters. Businesses aren't able to reopen. We know that on average, about 25% of businesses don't reopen after a disaster. That has implications on jobs. That has implications on who can live there. People might move away because they don't want to deal with the flood risk. All of a sudden, you have taxes, both from your sales tax or property tax, going down right at the moment when you need the money the most. at the same time, you have our credit agencies saying, well, this is a risky place, and your credit rating can actually take a hit again. So not only are you experiencing decreased revenue at the local government, but now it's more expensive to actually borrow the money that you definitely need to make capital improvements, say to your water, your road infrastructure that's been damaged. On the flip side, communities that have thought about these impacts, planned ahead, they have good systems, they're working well with our state and federal agencies. You know, the hope is that we have the recovery framework to get ahead of those impacts and make sure that the community is positioned for a full recovery, both economically and socially.
In the planning world, I think that this approach to recovery planning is really new, and it hasn't really fully caught on. And it has meant that not just rural places suffer and struggle to rebuild, it also means major American cities that experience disasters are devastated in all the ways that you talk about. And just one really high profile example that I think most people will be familiar with is New Orleans. After Hurricane Katrina more than 20 years ago, New Orleans still has not recovered from the hurricane. The population has not returned to what it used to be. And the difficulty of recovering and rebuilding in New Orleans also drove a mass exodus of people from the city to nearby places like Houston. And for Houston, that was a huge benefit. Houston got a much more diverse population, a lot of entrepreneurs and businesses, a lot of really rich culture left New Orleans seeking safer places. This makes me wonder, in order to prevent these cascading economic effects from happening post-disaster, does that mean that communities are better off finding ways for their residents to stay, even if the risk of a repeat disaster is really high?
I think when you recognize all of the negative impacts that can happen to a community after a disaster, if the local community wants to fully recover, it's really important to think about all of the different partnerships you're going to need in place to make that recovery possible. The local community is not going to be able to do it on its own. They need state and federal support. They're going to need support from the private sector. They're going to need support from our philanthropic partners as well. It's really an all hands on deck because, as we've talked about, the magnitude of the impacts and the risks that your community could slide into a negative trajectory are very real and very high. And how do you get on top of that? I think we've seen some really interesting solutions, you know, recognizing that disaster gentrification is an issue that developers might come in and try to take advantage of really low prices for land. Can you put that land in a land bank instead? Can you work with a land trust to try to create some affordable housing options in the long term? I think it's really important to acknowledge like this range of negative impacts that can happen and try to plan ahead. And again, you have to do that before. And for some communities, that's going to be too big of a lift in and of itself. And in that case, this really requires a more regional response. So not just putting the onus on small local communities that may not have the capacity to do it yet, but connecting to the dots to say, okay, we're as a county or maybe as multiple counties, how can we prepare for this disaster? We know it's going to happen at some point. What's our recovery process going to look like?
Follow up on that, because I think in the wildfire world, there's a lot of similarities between what happened in New Orleans. And if you look at Lahaina, one of their big fears after the fire was the gentrification, right? You had this significant fear of outside investors buying up this devastated land and further displacement of the local Native Hawaiian people that have lived there. And in Hawaii, on Maui, there's not another big city these people could go to.
It's
not a Houston they could go to. You know, and Lahaina already faced a severe affordable housing crisis due to the rise in short-term vacation rentals they had on the island, right? And the wildfire compounded this by displacing thousands of people and making it incredibly difficult for these long-term residents to even find a place to live. You know, you see these similarities, whether it's flooding or fire, in terms of what happens to that local population. You lose people. People may not want to come back in there because of the arduous task and wait times and cost. And, you know, especially if they're underinsured, they just can't afford to move back into there. And not to mention, just like in all these places, that the role of trying to remove debris and hazardous materials and the environmental concerns, like in Lahaina, it's the ash runoff devastating the coral reefs out there, which are a huge tourist draw to them. And so there's all these things that they had not prepared for that they're seeing that are similar to the flooding type issues that a community faces, far more than just the economic ramifications.
So this conversation has evolved to address not so much whether or not we need to rebuild, but whether or not we need to prepare for a disaster. And I think part of the difficulty of planning for a disaster recovery is admitting first that we live in a place where something bad can happen to us. And I think that's a fundamentally hard thing for communities to do, you know, to admit, like, we're going to have a fire, we're going to have a flood. It seems somewhat counterintuitive to be, I don't know, planning for the worst thing possible, but yet we are all, this sounds simple, we're all better off for doing it. So if I go back to my original question, should you rebuild after a disaster? The answer is really nuanced, but it sounds like yes, we should seriously consider it for a whole host of reasons, to include there is often nowhere else safer to go. Local economies and people do better when they can continue to live where financial and social networks already exist, where they have jobs and family and friends. There are, of course, some examples, particularly in the flooding world, where recurrent flooding is too devastating to stay. I'll just say that as a caveat. But if the answer is that we need to rebuild, I want to know, how do we do it? Particularly given what we know about disaster risk, we know that this risk remains the same over time. So in general, that suggests that we shouldn't be crazy and expect to do nothing differently and get a different result. The challenge, I think, with wildfire, though, is that these regulations that would make our homes more resilient against fire, so effectively building codes that mean our homes are less flammable, less burnable, these codes are optional. There is no federal requirement that rebuilding after a wildfire has to be done differently or better or safer.
No, you're exactly right. And that's where we kind of need this paradigm shift, right? And so we're rebuilding the same homes that burnt down this last time, but understanding that we can build homes that are resistant to wildfire as quickly, in most cases, as affordably as previous homes. And a lot of the materials they're using now do that: fiber cement siding, Class A roofs. You know, so it's simple things they can do when they rebuild that can make that community safer in the future when that wildfire hits again, because as we've seen in California, those burn scars are reburnt every 20, 30 years.
Right. And we just did some research in Headwaters, I'll just mention quickly, and we'll link to it in the show notes, that shows that if you have a wildland-urban interface building code in place before a fire, it is actually easier to rebuild and more affordable for most people. So it's just a good idea economically. But so this is where I'm particularly fascinated by the approach to rebuilding from the flood world, Chris, because unlike wildfire, flooding, rebuilding, and building the floodplains is regulated by the federal government. And I think that that can affect how and where you rebuild, right?
There are regulations for how to rebuild after a flood, particularly for the special flood hazard area that's regulated by FEMA, or if you're in the floodway and it's a no-build zone. And those are really important for, again, for keeping our most risky areas developed in a kind of strategic and thoughtful way. The other thing I want to just note, though, is we know that a lot of areas that are flooding and maybe even repetitively flooding aren't in that regulated area. So when I think about this question, to me, the question is really, do we have necessary resources available for communities so that they can recover in the way that makes the most sense for their context? And I'll just give one example, which is a community that Headwaters has been working with for years. There is a mobile home park in the floodplain. It's very vulnerable to flooding. It flooded extensively in the last decade. And you might look at those houses and say, well, they're in the floodplain. It's very high risk. We should just get them out of there. But when you actually go to that community and start talking to the neighborhood residents, it becomes really clear that this is a group of people that have very strong social connections. It's a very tight community. They help each other out with childcare, with food. It is a neighborhood that serves a large employer next door so that they don't have to have a car to walk over to their employment area. So the idea of actually buying out that neighborhood and getting folks out would completely destroy this incredibly important social safety network that the neighbors have connected amongst each other. And it just illustrates the trade-offs here. On the one hand, you could buy them out and decrease their flood risk, but would you actually be making them more vulnerable to disasters? Because if a disaster hit, now you've destroyed their support network that they would have relied on. So for me, I guess, as an outsider looking at that situation, I think these are really tough trade-offs that just have to be made locally. When we've talked to the neighbors in that particular area, there's been no interest in wanting to move. They want to stay together. And so at that point, you say that's the decision. There's not a clear way to decrease your flood risk. Instead, the best thing that we can do is just make sure that there is really good floodproofing, temporary floodproofing available to them, and really strong evacuation plan. If and when a flood occurs, there's a far less likelihood of things like loss of life.
This is what I think is really missing in this conversation about rebuilding, and also missing in the conversation about relocation and climate migration. The sense of like social fabric of a community and how much that is not recreatable when you go somewhere else as we consider reconstructing our communities after a disaster. It's not just rebuilding a new home and getting an insurance payout and counting the number of homes that have been rebuilt. It is also ensuring that everything else that makes our community work is replaced. Everything from better pipes and water infrastructure to jobs and economics and tax base and social networks and affordable homes, homes that fit your cultural needs and expectations and what your environment is. When we're deciding whether to rebuild or not rebuild after a disaster, there's a certain amount of risk we are choosing to accept in order to preserve our communities. There's a lot to learn from Lahaina here because some of the work that they have done has really prioritized keeping local people and Native Hawaiians in place if they want to be there, and also ensuring that the homes they're building look like what they always had and look like what they want to have, which is frankly unlike any other type of home we see in the country. We have published some rebuilding guides that may be interesting for listeners to look at, and we can link to them in the show notes so people can see what these homes look like.
And I think the last piece of that that's crucial is that it needs to be people from the community deciding how, where, and what these communities need to look like, not people from who are trying to help, but coming from the outside doing that for them. I know in Lahaina, an organization called Hawaii Wildfire Management Organization works really closely with them, and they're able to, again, bring that those community leaders and that community input together to help that rebuilding process. I think whether it be in Lahaina or anywhere we've seen these disasters happen, making sure that it's being led at the community scale is probably the foundation for rebuilding that community fabric.
When we talked about this in our prep conversation, you said something really great about like there are always risks. There are risks with staying, there are risks with leaving. But for some communities, the risks of leaving poses greater, broader losses.
And the trade-offs of whether you stay or go have to be, you know, thought of and thought through at the local level, the community level, to make sure that people understand what they're signing up for and that the outcomes are what the community wants.
That's a hard statement because the risks may not be worth it. I mean, the risk may be worth it for the value of the community, but it may not be worth it for the individual.
And not to mention, a lot of these communities are reliant on federal money to help them, which is paid for by the American public. And that, frankly, is a question for a whole nother podcast. So I think that's a good place to leave it today. I know this conversation leaves many stones unturned. I still have many burning questions about insurance and public financing and how disasters bankrupt communities. But good news, Chris will be joining me in our next episode to delve deeper into those very questions. But for now, Chris and Doug, thank you so much for joining me and talking through this.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Doug.
And thanks so much for listening. Please join us for our next episode when Chris and I will be talking about how disasters bankrupt communities and what you can do about it.
Hey, Thanks for listening to this episode of Burning Questions, a podcast about wildfire. To see more about our work, visit us at headwaterseconomics.org. This episode was produced by Ryan Handy, Doug Green, and edited by Brent Powell. This podcast is a production of Headwaters Economics. If you found this episode valuable, please share it with others. This organization is an equal opportunity provider.